Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the Extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
It's River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Artificial intelligence, the creation and application of human-like intelligence, has become a transformative force. We're just seeing the beginning. It's revolutionizing industries, reshaping our society. Today on the program, three perspectives on artificial intelligence, AI. Later this half hour, we'll hear from someone who teaches a class on AI and journalism at the University of Iowa, then someone who formerly worked on global security at Meta. He'll talk about his and his colleagues' investigation into AI disinformation. It started with a small Iowa newspaper. But first, earlier this week, I spoke with Martin Roth. Martin is a professor of philosophy at Drake University. He helped co-found the AI major and minor at Drake. Martin Roth, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into how this major started at Drake University, tell us a little bit about your scholarly area of study, philosophy, and how AI fits into that. What's interesting for a philosopher about AI?
One of the long-standing philosophical questions that humans have asked themselves concerns the nature of human intelligence, the nature of the human consciousness, the nature of the human mind. We think of this as a subject matter of psychology, of course, but interest, philosophical interest in the nature of thinking and perception and consciousness goes back for thousands of years. From my point of view, when I think of AI, I think of folks like Alan Turing. I think of his work in the 1930s and the 1940s and the 1950s. And really, the basic idea emerged from that work was the claim, the hypothesis, the startling, astonishing, and maybe true hypothesis that our minds are computers, that what accounts for our intelligence, our ability to reason in the way that we do, is that we are a computer. We are not made of silicon. We're not made of wire. We are made of neurons. And yet, what's fundamental or essential to understanding our cognition and intelligence is computation. Mm-hmm. So work in AI, really, since the 40s and the 50s, was really occurred hand in hand with the study of the human mind. So it intersected with psychology and neuroscience. So AI has, at least for some people like myself, might hold the key to understanding our very own ability to think and be conscious.
Yeah. And you mentioned Alan Turing, the Turing test. Perhaps you can briefly tell us what that is, because that plays a role here, doesn't it?
It does. So Turing knew that people would have a hard time taking seriously the idea of a machine that could think. And so he said, well, let's devise a test where, right, that would really be a kind of probe for really trying to get distill what was most important to intelligence. And Turing hit on an idea that had been articulated hundreds of years before by the very famous philosopher and mathematician René Descartes. Descartes said that intelligence was the ability to discourse sensibly, basically to talk sensibly, mm-hmm. on an open-ended number of topics. And Turing took that idea and said, hey, suppose you take a person and you have them start to kind of have a conversation with two systems. One's a human, one's a computer. And at the beginning, the interrogator doesn't know which is which. If after a certain amount of time, right, the interrogator can ask as many questions as they'd like, if at the end of that process, the interrogator thinks that the thing that's the human, or the thing that's the computer, is the human, and Turing says we should call that computer, say that it has as much as intelligence as any human being.
Right. And we know that came into play recently in the news with ChatGPT. But let's leave that aside for the moment and get into the discussion of how AI came to be a major and a minor at Drake. What kicked it off?
Well, so many of your audience members probably might, you know, when they think about AI, in popular culture, like me, many of them might remember those commercials of Microsoft commercials featuring the rapper Common. It kind of AI just sort of one seemed like overnight exploded on the scene and everyone was talking about it. Well, people were talking about it in business and people were talking about it in higher education. And the president of Drake our President Martin, came back from a conference where he was meeting with a bunch of presidents of universities and said, the central theme of this conference was about how is AI going to affect higher education, right? And what are we going to do as educators to kind of deal with that future? So he got a group of folks together to start talking about, trying to think, in a future-directed way, how do we get ahead of AI? How do we create an education at Drake that is going to enable our students to successfully navigate a world where AI is going to be increasingly important? And that kind of just kicked off the process, and the provost got a group of people together and then selected me and a business colleague of mine, a colleague in the College of Business, to kind of spearhead this initiative to create a major program around AI.
AI is so big. We have, the whole spectrum, the technical side, computer science, math, but all the way to the humanities, your area, philosophy, ethics. How did you tackle such a many-armed beast, if I can put it that way?
That's a good question. So what you said is exactly right. So we start with this idea that AI is not just it's not just a matter of some kind of coding. It's not just technical computer science stuff. AI is this enormous phenomenon that encompasses technical, mathematical aspects. It impacts society at large. It raises a host of legal and ethical questions, right? The future of employment. It raises these profound questions about what it is to think and what it is to be conscious. So we thought, look, the only way that a student can meaningfully engage with AI as a phenomenon is by taking courses from a variety of disciplines that have something important to offer in understanding the phenomenon. So we really crafted a major that was around, on the one hand, math and computer science, on the other hand, humanities and social science. And in the third sort of dimension was about design and business application, so that students could, having taken the major, if they majored in it, go out into the world and be able to speak computer science a little bit, speak a little business, speak a little ethics and a little social science. And we thought that is really what we want our citizens leaving Drake. We want them prepared to have those kinds of conversations.
Mm-hmm. When did you first offer this as a major at Drake?
We started planning in 2019, and COVID kind of delayed a little bit the rolling out of it. By the spring of 2021, we were up and running.
Yeah. And students within this major have the option of emphasizing one area or another?
Yeah. So some students, right, they might want to go into the job market and do a lot of coding. And they're going to need to take more computer science and math courses. And so they can focus on the mathematical side of the program. Some students might be more interested in the humanities angle. Mm-hmm. They might take more classes in English literature. As most people probably know, AI has been a subject of much science fiction and literature. So they might focus more on philosophy and English and so forth. So yeah, students can kind of emphasize different areas depending on their own interests and, how they're imagining their future careers.
Yeah. What do you see as the main challenges you've faced so far with your colleagues in offering this major, a major that really focuses on an area with such an incredible pace of change attached to it?
That is a great question. So one of the things that we try to do is we're looking for ways to kind of creating new courses as the major continues to grow. It's been very successful. So we're looking at ways of developing even further courses that are going to allow students to kind of tackle new issues as they arise. We've been really good, too, at trying to have on campus something like public forums that will enable faculty and students to get together and talk about these rapid changes. So in the spring of 2023, I helped organize a couple of forums on Drake's campus that were open to the public and encouraged students and faculty to start talking about, right, some of these, these changes. They are happening at an incredible rate. So we had a whole forum organized around ChatGPT, right? Everyone's sort of favorite example. So, it is a challenge because it's hard to predict what the future is going to be. We're trying to kind of prepare our students to be able to develop skills and a knowledge base, allow them to kind of manage what the future may hold, even if we don't know the particular details. But yeah, that is one of the biggest challenges, just staying ahead of all the rapid development.
Mm-hmm. How many AI majors are there at colleges and universities around the country, to your knowledge? How unique is this?
Well, there aren't a lot. So, if you sort of look around the country now and you ask, all right, how many undergraduate AI programs are there? There are not a lot. Now, very recently, Purdue University in Indiana, a very large school that a lot of people know about, they created an AI major. Their AI program, like ours, has puts a lot of emphasis on humanities and particularly philosophy, because they recognize the role that philosophy plays in AI. But, you know, really, you won't find a lot of programs at the undergraduate level that attempt to deal with AI in a way that goes beyond sort of the math, computer science aspect of it. So there just really aren't a lot of programs like that. There are more now, but we were kind of really one of a kind in many ways.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, is AI a sexy major from what you can tell? High status, a lot of cachet attached to it?
I don't talk to students about, you know, the glitter factor, the glamour factor, but I'll tell you what. I teach philosophy courses. Many of them are specifically geared towards the topic of AI. I teach a philosophy of AI course, for example. And I know this much. The students who take it are, you know, many of them are students who are planning to major in AI or minor. And it is very clear to me that their interest level in AI, in its full complexity, is incredibly high. So this interest in AI is not, I don't think, primarily driven by an interest in, say, computer science or math. What I find are students who are grappling with and really wanting to get their heads around these very complicated kinds of challenges that they sort of see AI posing for the future of labor, for the future of society. And they're really interested in these philosophical questions about, you know, machines having a moral status, or can machines be conscious? So yeah. I think there is an excitement based around the way in which AI is just this incredibly interesting subject.
Martin, we have to take a short break. We'll be back more with Martin Roth, professor of philosophy at Drake University, one of the people on his campus helping to co-found the AI major and minor at Drake. It's River to River from IPR News.
Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back with more of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer, talking about AI today. We're getting several perspectives on how this is revolutionizing and reshaping our work, our society. Martin Roth, professor of philosophy at Drake University. Let's get back to my conversation with him earlier this week. He helped to co-found the AI major and minor at Drake. Martin, so let's talk about the concerns, the hopes and the fears. Let's start with the fears, the concerns. In creating human-like intelligence as a philosopher with this AI major, what are the greatest concerns you're addressing?
There are so many of them, but here's one that I often share with my students, and it really is a kind of one of the goals of my classes, is that I find that it is easy for students to either not directly confront or just simply downplay the prospect of synthesizing, if you will, genuine instances of machine intelligence, creating things that are really no different from you and I in terms of their ability to think and their ability to feel and their ability and their capacity for having aspirations and goals. And if you don't take that seriously as a possibility, what you'll do is I fear that we will create ever more complicated systems, and we won't realize that we might actually bring into existence beings that have a moral status, that we should start to really concern ourselves about how we treat them. Mm-hmm. I fear that it's going to be very easy to imagine a future in which we have these intelligent beings that we are trying to treat as property, thinking of them as we could just turn them off or on at our own pleasure, mm-hmm. Where that might actually be a lot more complicated, that really we're actually on the, you know, we might actually be bringing into existence moral agents that we should respect. So one fear I have is that people aren't going to take seriously enough the thought that we could actually create AIs that were like us. Yeah. In the ways that matter morally.
It sounds like you're talking about this concept of the technological singularity of AI as well. This is the hypothetical future point in time. A lot of chat around this, where the technological growth becomes uncontrollable, irreversible, and we have unforeseen consequences for human civilization. AI run amok, right?
Yeah, I mean, and this is, of course, that is also an important concern, getting ahead. I mean, and here's one of the reasons why that's concerning in a way that sort of builds up from something that seems like pretty kind of mundane. You know, if we ask ourselves what happened that made AI sort of take off, like it's been around for decades. So why only now has it garnered all of this attention? Well, put very, very compactly, it really was the confluence, the bringing together of two things. One, neural network models for learning with big data. And when you combine big data with these neural network models, we found these profound results. Now, one interesting thing about these neural network models, without getting into the details, mm-hmm. is that they learn to solve problems in a way where we're not exactly sure how they're solving them.
Right.
It's like, wow, we trained it to complete this task and it did it and it generalizes to new data very well. Well, what did it do? What did it learn exactly? We don't know. Now, if you think about that, right, before in the sort of old days, if you wanted to build an AI system to do anything at all, you basically needed to know how to write the program for it. And so at least the advantage there was that the programmer kind of knew how the thing worked. Now it's like we train networks to do these incredible tasks, yet they're almost in some ways indecipherable to us. If that's true, then it makes the gap between our understanding, I mean, it increases that sort of gap. And we might think, well, who knows what's going on under the hood, right?
Yeah.
Who knows? It might be learning things that we're completely unaware of and using that in some ways to develop forms of understanding or consciousness and maybe even kinds of control that we're simply completely blind to. So yes, there's a real danger here that our machines are gonna become more and more complicated, more and more hard to understand, and thus much more unpredictable.
Yeah. You know, safely harnessing AI, I mean, do you think we're up to the task when, for instance, we seem unable to remedy what should be a more simple, solvable problem like gun violence? AI is much bigger than that, and you just described how we don't even know where we're headed. How can we even imagine that we have a harness on this?
So, right. I'm glad you brought up gun violence. And I want to use, you know, another kind of example without getting too much into the, you know, I don't know, the politics of this or where the controversy is. I guess I want to say that for a lot of people, it's pretty much received knowledge that, say, the climate crisis has been on the horizon, right, for many decades now, right? I mean, we knew about it 30 years ago, right? People were like, look, warning. And you can look at that and all the ways in which we might have seen like inaction, right? Like, wow, we were really kind of slow. Like there was a lot of inaction and we weren't really up to the task of solving this big problem. And then I'm going to say, well, what were the reasons? You could point to the normal forces at work, right? I mean, various, you know, you might think about profit and companies not wanting to change because it's expensive and just having political will and global, you know, diplomacy. And so, yeah, I am a little bit worried that we might not be fully prepared to deal with this. And one of the things that I think is the most challenging aspect of this is that, you know, I think that we need to imagine these issues and these questions, how do they get solved? I think we need to have a model in which these issues are discussed and decisions are made that is more fundamentally democratic. So a lot of philosophers of science really like to, talk about this notion of like well-ordered science. How do you conduct science and how do you sort of settle these questions about technology in a democracy? And I think it's fairly clear that a lot of people just aren't represented in the decision-making process for how we, what, which technologies we're going to pursue and develop and which ones we're not and for what ends. You know, I think it's, to me, I don't think there's anything about AI that creates some kind of moral imperative to keep, you know, to pursue it. We might as a society decide it's not worth it, that there's too many risks, and to say, let's just not do this. My concern is that the decision-making isn't going to be reflective of the values and interests of the people whose lives it is poised to affect. Mm. So there, I would, you know, for me, if I was like, what does that mean? I would want to there be a kind of call for more democratic representation in the decision-making process for like how we fund technology and for what purposes.
Yeah. Martin Roth, that's all the time we have for today. I could, speaking for myself, I could talk with you all day about this. You're fascinating. Professor of philosophy at Drake University, for instance, when we check back, perhaps, what is consciousness and can AI ever achieve consciousness? We'll set that that small question off to the side. How about that, Martin?
Ben, thank you. But, you know, if you come back to me and ask that in a year from now, I might be replaced by an AI system. So, you know, which might be for the better. Who knows? But thank you very much for having me.
Martin Roth, professor of philosophy at Drake University. Take care, Martin.
Bye-bye.
It's River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Artificial intelligence, the imitation by computers of the intelligence inherent in us, humans. It's become a transformative force. It's revolutionizing industries, reshaping our society. Today, perspectives on AI from several guests. Justin Kosner is a lecturer of rhetoric at the University of Iowa. He teaches a class on AI and journalism. I spoke with him earlier this week. Justin, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
Now, AI isn't the first. It won't be the last technology to upset the journalistic status quo. I think we can safely say that. We had the telegraph. This is long before you and I, the telegraph, the telephone, allowing these dispatches to be filed much quicker. But when you teach journalism students today about AI, where do you start?
That's a great question. And I actually usually start in the past. I do think it's important to get a sense for journalism's history as well as the technological sort of intersections with that history. So we often look at a book by Neil Postman who does talk about the telegraph and he talks about television. And in thinking about AI, we often think about how these technologies have already affected our journalism, but also how our journalism continues to be in flux and therefore sometimes changes itself.
I bet you I know the Neil Postman book you're talking about, Entertaining Ourselves to Death.
It is indeed one of my favorites.
What a person there to talk about how technology is affecting our brains and our society. So what do you do after that? How do you talk about it after that?
I see the class having sort of two different dimensions. One of them emerges from that technological strain. We read Neil Postman. We read thinkers today who are considering AI and its implications for our culture and our journalism. But we also read about and we read journalism, good journalism, and talk about what makes it good journalism. So we read things like Joan Didion. We read Ta-Nehisi Coates. We talk about what we want our journalism to do and how some of the expectations around journalism have shifted and what that will mean for AI. So, for instance, if our priorities in journalism are objectivity, sometimes we think that that might be something more easily accessed by a technology which can remove, you know, human biases and error. But if our priorities are things like insight or, you know, discrimination, not the bad discrimination, the good discrimination of being able to separate out quality from, falsehood or, truth from dross, then actually we really need these human elements in there. So as we talk about the intersections of AI and journalism, we really have to talk about both technology and also deeply human principles.
You brought up the idea of objectivity in journalism, and I'm wondering if AI is necessarily objective because it depends on the algorithm, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think one of the prevailing metaphors in our class, much like people have talked about the metaphor of children learning from parents, sometimes not exactly what parents want to teach them, we are seeing with AI that it reflects sometimes what we ask it more than what we want from it. So recently, to your, comment about objectivity, Google Gemini came out with an image producer, which was able to craft images in the same way that ChatGPT would craft a response. They wanted to get ahead of potential problems and things like biases and prejudices, so they implemented into the coding a prioritization of diversity. Now, this sounds great, but anybody who's raised a toddler knows you don't always get what you ask for. The image generator very quickly produced problematic images of things like when you asked it to show a German soldier from World War II, it would show a diverse cast of different racial and ethnic backgrounds of those soldiers. So I think one of the things that we see with trying to encode our values into AI, as you suggested, is that the AI doesn't have a human discretion. Instead, it can only produce what the encoders are able to incentivize in its production.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us some examples of AI at work in journalism now before we get into what we anticipate its uses in the future in journalism?
Yeah, this is another important thing. I think one of the experiences of teaching this class has been fielding some amount of anxiety from students about AI. It's a scary term that often carries with it connotations of the Terminator and Skynet. But we already use AI in terms of like spell checking, for instance. Mm-hmm. And we see AI emerging in journalism in things like algorithmic recommendations for audiences, fact-checking programs, programs that, look through large data sets for patterns to, tease out important numbers or tendencies. We have AI that can distill large documents and, provide us with sort of bullet points. The real thing we're looking at now is generative AI, AI that is able to produce the content itself that used to be this rather sole domain of human writers.
And where is that part right now?
That is what I would say is deeply in flux. The London School of Economics published the AI Journalism Survey recently, which did a big global survey, which I think is important to keep in mind. Oftentimes, it's easy to think of this in terms of the U.S. ecosystem of news. But of course, AI is going to, infuse the entire global ecosystem. And one of the things we're seeing is that there is a gap between the global north and the global south in how AI is being adopted and implemented. And there's worries that the gap will actually widen rather than diminish in time, that the more established news companies will be able to implement technologies more quickly than emerging news companies. And the concerns that carries with it are that we'll see a sort of centralization of news to already established news companies. And there's a host of other concerns that have to do with where we see humans in this process.
Right. And that gets to a question I'd like to ask you is, when you're teaching future journalists, how should they relate to current AIs? Are they to think of AI as a knowledgeable colleague, a reliable source, or perhaps as a lousy intern who doesn't get things right along a lot of the time?
I think that last one is probably where we are now. The science fiction author Ched Chiang has a phrase that he calls ChatGPT a blurry JPEG of the web. And what he means by that is that it's like a clumsy approximation of information. And that's probably where it's best right now. I do think that we will see AI taking a larger and more substantial role in the future. But the buzz phrase in journalism and ethics circles has been a human in the loop. So making sure that whatever it is AI is doing is always being vetted and passes through a human agent who is able to assess how this intern is working and whether or not it is, you know, up to the standards of the newsroom.
Mm-hmm. Can an average consumer discern an article written today completely by AI from one from a human?
I will say that I have had the best luck discerning AI by its impeccable grammar. So I think it's quite difficult.
To err is human.
Yes, there it is. a new title to my you know, my class, I think. That in some ways I think that gets at where the problem is that AI's precision in language belies the dearth of discrimination. And I use that word in a positive sense, its ability to determine values or to make distinctions between what is important or unimportant or of, you know, central, you know, concern or peripheral.
After a short break, the rest of my conversation with Justin Kausner. Justin teaches about AI and journalism at the University of Iowa. Then later in the program, we'll hear how a small Iowa newspaper's website became an AI-generated clickbait factory. It's River to River from IPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Let's get back to that conversation with Justin Kausner, who teaches about AI and journalism at the University of Iowa. At this point, we were discussing what AI can and can't do in the field of journalism.
I think a lot of people remember in Katrina when a journalist blew up at the FEMA director for sort of deferring the, you know, the human cost that we were seeing in the Katrina catastrophe. And I think this is the sort of thing that an AI obviously could never do. It could never call a politician on ignoring the human factor. It's never going to identify in a story a deep irony. It's never going to be able to tease out a topical concern that, you know, we might have. One of the stories my class reads, because we read a lot about technology, but we also just read some great journalism, is The Really Big One. It's a piece of journalism by Dana Schultz, I think. And in it, she traces the upcoming earthquake in the American Pacific Northwest. And one of the things she locates is the indigenous tribes' historical record that would have told modern science that this was coming, but because of the prejudices, in what we consider, you know, science and sound research, it wasn't looked at. And I think an AI could never identify that in this story about an upcoming earthquake, there's also a story about indigeneity and knowledge and America.
Mm-hmm. For the journalist students you have, what else are they most worried about? I guess in a small, narrow focus, they want to know, can I make a living in the future with AI there? To what degree will AI be replacing humans?
Yeah, it's demanding some very difficult questions, as you started us off. I think there is a tendency to overweigh the new technology and imagine it's going to radically dismantle the status quo, when often it doesn't. I actually asked my students, you know, just last week, we reached the midterm, and I said, you know, what are your thoughts here? And a lot of students expressed learning about AI actually suppressed some of their fears.
Really?
We started the class in our introductions day. We played the two truths and a lie, and we let an AI make up the lie for us. And so we did our introduction games through, like, responses created by ChatGPT. And what was really remarkable is how robotic and similar all their answers were. And I think that was the beginning of students realizing the real limitations of these devices.
At this rudimentary phase,
yes,
though.
That is true. It is moving quickly. But I do think that one of the things that we will also see is a question of, in the same way that there is interest in homemade pottery, in organic foods, in locally grown foods, we often see, I think, a backlash to the homogenizing forces of, you know, our you know, world, and such that I suspect once content on anything of a certain, you know, technological quality is available, people will look for more human content.
Mm-hmm. Justin, talk about the issue of transparency here. When we as consumers know when AI is being used and when it isn't, what do journalists students then need to know about that?
Alondra Nelson, Dr. Alondra Nelson, the deputy director of the Office of Technology and Science Policy under Biden for a time, helped produce the blueprint for AI Bill of Rights. And transparency is one of the key terms here. And one of the things she pushes for is for a policy that asks that consumers always know when AI is playing a role. One of the problems with AI is that it is something of a black box even unto itself, and we don't know what's going on in there. And so we are asking not just the policy that AI be transparent and when it's being used, but also that we know how it's working more clearly. Because as of right now, there's not a lot of demand on the tech companies who are producing AI to demonstrate what it is, in fact, these devices are doing as they're producing their content.
And as we're consuming news media, we have to become savvy to demanding that.
Yes. I mean, all of this in my mind comes back to another class I teach, which is rhetoric, and talking to students about media literacy and being able to detect, biases and fallacies and the sorts of things that happen in our news which can mislead us away from understanding rather than towards it.
Deepfakes have been a big part of this conversation, Justin. Concerns about, making someone say or do something in a photo, a video, or audio that actually never really happened. And we're seeing this pop up in social media in all kinds of ways. Since journalism is about discerning fact from fiction, at least that's what we aim for it to be, how can that be dealt with, deepfakes, that will be increasingly harder to tell, where it will be increasingly difficult to tell what is real and what isn't?
It's such a great question. I don't think anyone has a perfect answer. I'm actually going to raise another side of this, Brooke Gladstone in The Influencing Machine, her book on media.
Co-host of On the Media.
That's right. She points out that one of the fears of Photoshop is not that we will think something false is true, but that we will no longer believe anything is necessarily true. That
muddies the waters completely.
Absolutely. And so I think the more concerning fear for me, especially in an age of mis and disinformation and conspiracism, will be an erosion of the authority of an image or a news story or a video and saying, this is true, look, we have evidence. So I actually think that is the primary fear for me. But I do think, once again, it comes back to some things you already raised, questions of transparency and questions of media literacy, that the more media literate our population, I think the more they will be able to identify where these images are coming from, you know, who is using them, and especially if we can have policy which, you know, watermarks in some fashion AI-produced content, that will be easier to track.
Yeah. Huge implications for democracy.
Absolutely. I know that there is, you know, there's images being leaked of celebrities that, you know, include like breaches of privacy. But there's also, you know, stories coming out of the Russia-Ukraine war in which, AI may be being used to sow disinformation among troops of different sides, you know, about, orders and policy and the direction of the war itself.
Okay. So many fascinating things to discuss here. Justin Kausner, lecturer of rhetoric at the University of Iowa, teaches a class on AI and journalism. Justin, in my conversation with you, I have to come to the conclusion your students are well served with all the provocative questions you're raising here and answers.
Oh, thank you. I mean, I think questions is mostly what we have right now. and I will say, you know, just to the listeners out there and to echo my class, I think there's as much excitement here as there is trepidation. And, you know, with any of these new technologies comes the opportunity to not just do new things as humans, but also to redouble down on our, you know, humanistic values and identify them and hold them all the tighter.
Thank you, Justin.
Thank you.
It's River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. And finally today, in our conversations about the promise and peril of artificial intelligence, this, the story of how a small Iowa newspaper's website became an AI-generated clickbait factory. I'm joined now by Tony Easton. Tony is a trust and safety consultant, also a former employee of Meta. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Ben.
Before we get to the main event, the story of this small-town newspaper in Iowa, tell us a little bit about your background, how you came to work for Meta. This is the parent company of Facebook, Instagram, and Threads.
Yeah, so happy to be here. So before Meta, I used to be what's known as a psychological operations officer for the Department of Defense, specifically the Air Force. I did that for 8 years. One of the ways that I got to Meta was to actually identify different vulnerabilities and then published those findings when I was still in the Air Force. And I had some friends that worked in the tech industry that saw my work, and they were interested in me coming to join them, specifically in their global operations investigations team, understanding what makes those adversaries think, why they do the things that they do, understand those behavioral signals associated with the things. And when I say these things, I'm talking about fraud, influence operations, disinformation, child safety, like all the worst things that you can possibly think of. And my job was to understand those behavioral signals. And then from using those behavioral signals, find either policy gaps that we could potentially kind of plug in to, or find a new ways in order for us to automatically identify whenever somebody does something bad.
Wow. Fascinating work. We could spend a lot of time talking about that, but let's jump forward to the focus of this conversation to 2023, I believe. Tell us the story of how the Clayton County Register, this is a newspaper in Northeast Iowa. It covers the small town of Elkader, also wider Clayton County, how this landed on your radar.
Yeah, so probably like many of your listeners, one of the things that I like to dabble in is retail investing. And I'm sure like many of your listeners, one of the companies that I thought about looking into was this company called Amneal Pharmaceutical. Now, I didn't know anything about Amneal Pharmaceutical. So obviously, my next step was going to Google it, right? Google it, go to Google News, find out a little bit more about what that company is, what they do, what they sell, all of that good stuff. Now, as I'm doing all of this search, I come across this website, ClaytonCountyRegister.com. And at first, it looked like an official website when you look at just the address itself. But when you click on it, I quickly realized that the entire website had Gen AI, generative artificial intelligence images throughout the site itself. And then as I started reading a bunch of the different articles associated with it, I started to realize also very quickly that these are not your standard authors that have written this. This is all, in fact, generative artificial intelligence articles. So I started doing a little bit of digging at that point because I asked myself, why do they have that web address? Why do they have the Clayton County Register? And when you actually were to visit Clayton County, the official government website, they actually listed that site as one of the places to get your local news information.
So what did you find out? Because now the Clayton County Register used to be a real local newspaper, but then somebody else got a hold of this domain and is using it for other purposes?
Basically, what we found out is that the individuals behind the Clayton County Register, they snatched up that domain whenever Clayton County stopped renewing that domain. So if you had a lot of individuals that would typically visit your website, there's actually ways to find that out. And then there are systems in place that these individuals can find out, hey, this domain is now available to the public. I can purchase it, because typically, like every month, you know, there's like 1,000 people that click on that, which is pretty good. So that's exactly what this individual did. He found a bunch of different domains, and one of them was the Clayton County Register. And then as soon as it became public, he snatched it up and then turned it into an automated generative AI articles filled with fake authors as well as fake stories.
Yeah, right. You had one that named Emmanuel Ellerby, credited with publishing tens of thousands of articles, you found out. But let's jump to, before we end this conversation, the takeaways from this story for those listening. How to identify AI-generated articles and what to do, and really the threat that they pose.
Yeah, so you actually hit one of the tactics on how to identify it. And one of the first things that I tell listeners or anybody is, first, pay attention to who the author is. Like, do a quick Google search into the author. Figure out, hey, is this individual real? And one of the ways that you can find out whether or not they're real is there are sites out there that will tell you how many articles they have written. And I will tell you that from a journalistic perspective, it is impossible for an author to start into their career in 6 months and then have 100,000 articles credited. It's just impossible. Another telltale sign is the images that are used within that platform, you know, because again, humans have a tendency to be inherently lazy. They'll try to find the quickest way to push out information. And one of those ways for these individuals is to leverage generative artificial intelligence images. And those images, as of right now, luckily for us, they're still very easy to identify. So if you see one of those Gen AI images attached with an article that seems suspicious because the author is not somebody that you recognize or somebody that has way too many articles, then there's probably a very good likelihood that they are in fact Gen AI articles. So be very, very careful as to what information you're going to take out of those articles.
There's money making as a goal here, but there's also more malicious intent here, concerning elections, confusion, shaping opinions, right?
Absolutely. So one of the biggest findings that we had was one of the networks of individuals that were using Gen AI to create these websites was actually a dark PR firm. What they were doing is actually creating fake articles in order to promote companies so that people would invest in those companies themselves. Now, if they can do this for the companies, now I can bet you with 100% certainty that that will be happening with political officials as well during elections. Because at the end of the day, the thing about generative artificial intelligence that people have to remember is that it allows a lot of information to be generated very, very quickly that can sometimes be indistinguishable from actual individuals, authors that have written it. So you start to be confused as to what is real, what is not real, which sometimes is the very purpose of what their action is to confuse the information environment.
Tony Easton, can you have any kind of hopeful outlook, because this technology will only advance, get better at fooling us, won't it?
It will. It will get better, but there is hope. The thing that we have to remember is that for every tool that is created by humans, there's always going to be somebody out there that is going to try to use it maliciously. But there will also always be people that try to use it for the good of the world. And I believe that we're just at one of those crossroads now, and we just have to hope that there's more people trying to use it for good than people trying to use it for bad things.
Okay. Welcome to our brave new world. And as Tony pointed out, beware. Tony Easton, trust and safety consultant and former Meta employee. Tony, fascinating story. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Ben. It was a pleasure.
And that's it for this show. Today's edition of River to River was produced by Danny Gear. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.